You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So, we may be talking about Tomb Raider today, but not about the video game. In 1922, the tomb of the young king Tutankhamun was uncovered by archaeologist Harold Carter, led by his patron George Herbert, the 5th Earl of Carnarvon, opening up widespread interest into ancient Egypt civilization. Since then, he has been long since suspected of stealing its treasures before the tomb was officially opened. These claims have been hard to validify, but a newly discovered letter penned by the renowned philologist Sir Alan Gardiner may hold the answer to the questions that have swelled up in the 100 years since the discovery of the tomb. Gardiner's letter was never published back in the day, but the letter details how Carter compensated his work translating the cave hieroglyphics with an amulet which was historically used as an offering for the dead. Despite being told by Carter that the amulet hadn't originated from the tomb, confirmation came from the then director of the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, Rich Engelbart, after testing other finds transported to the museum. To learn more about the controversy, history, and the context surrounding the tomb of Tutankhamun, I reached out to the University of Auckland professor Anthony Spallinger to discuss the news and more. First question I want to ask is if you could tell me a little bit about the historical context of the Tutankhamun dig.
Yes, well, this is the famous discovery of Howard Carter, and it was just, in a sense, serendipity. He didn't expect it. They knew they were in the Valley of the Kings. They were after an intact tomb, hopefully, and they discovered the tomb of Tutankhamun, which was not, by the way, the king's original tomb. He was moved there later. So it is an intact tomb, but it isn't king's first tomb. So it is as what you get with cemeteries, you know, you remove the bodies and put them somewhere else. And that's what happened, nothing against the king, of course. And in that, Carter spent a long time, and I've mentioned to this to other people, at least 10 years before there is even a preliminary publication of the work. He began in 21, he's still working in 31. And the reason is he had to deal with quite a number of people from outside. The Egyptian government, which, by the way, Bob Breyer does talk about, I think, too positively, because this was a transitional phase in Egypt. There is no king in 1921. There is King Fuad the first 2 or 3 years later when the English pulled out to a degree. They didn't establish dominion status, but they were occupied. They were the occupying powers of Egypt, you see, and there were riots soon after the First World War. So Carter, in a sense, had to deal with the nascent beginning movement of Egyptian nationalism. And at the same time, he had all the scholars, all of the archaeologists from wherever and whomever coming to bother him, really. And he was therefore preoccupied with that day in and day out. Now, with regard to Breyer's point of view, he did further research on the letters, really one key letter in 1934, in which Carter wrote to Alan Gardiner, later Sir Alan Gardiner. And I felt that the Guardian wasn't nice to Gardiner, because Gardiner is the greatest Egyptologist of all time. He's knighted, so it's Sir Alan, if you want to be exact, in 1934, and sent him this little amulet, you know, please translate, blah, blah, blah. And Gardiner realized this is probably 99% the case. It's from the tomb of Tutankhamun. Why is it here in England, right? That makes no sense. And he sent it back. But he didn't accuse anyone, but he knew that the head of the Egyptian Museum, who happened to be British at this time, this is Engelbach, would immediately latch on to the fact that at least one object is not supposed to be outside the country of Egypt. It's not supposed to be outside Cairo or the museum, to be precise, because everything was sent to the museum, because you can go and see the mummy. You can go. My specialty isn't I'm not interested in mummies. It's Bob Breyer who is. I'm interested in the chariots because I'm interested in Egyptian warfare. And it's an intact royal chariot, so it's really a major thing in excellent condition. Well, they can be seen by you, me, or anyone else in the new or revived Cairo Museum. But things did disappear, and I think that's what Breyer further goes into. He goes into a discussion that in certain museums, Metropolitan Museum of Art is one he the Guardian identifies, MMA, simply because the MMA sent back to Egypt in the 1970s a few things that they claimed they should not have. They did not identify how they got it. And therefore, there are the questions of how did certain objects, small but significant nonetheless, and it's national culture after all, it's come to get outside of Egypt to end up in museums and Whereouts we don't know, right? A private collection, you don't know. And who were the intermediaries? Was it Carter? Is it anyone he worked with? Because he has assistants. Breyer doesn't go into any great detail on that, but he's not working alone. He's got his photographer, Harry Burton, but Burton's not going to do anything like that. He's got other people coming in and out, and a few of the laborers who are moving. I don't know. I think it needs further investigation. But it's clear that certain objects that came from the intact tomb wound up outside of Egypt. And that's what Bob Breyer is discussing. And he's pointing out this one, which is, at least you have the letter in 1934 referring to it, and which Gardner doesn't really want to touch. I mean, not literally, but figuratively, he doesn't want to touch it. He knows that it doesn't belong there.
A huge part of the whole, like the last 100 years, in terms of it's opened the door wide open for understanding and learning about like ancient Egyptian culture, but at the same time, it's always been a question of, well, did Howard Carter rob the graves? Because it's always been like, there's been no proof before.
There's no proof. The thing that I was told actually two things, one of which is true. The throne chair of Tutankhamun, according to one Egyptologist, a great one from the United States that I studied with in Brown University, he's dead many years, Richard Parker, said that the Princess Eugenie, who's still alive, this is Napoleon III's wife and empress, sat on it, you know, it's crushed it because she obviously was not a young woman anymore in 1921. That's one of the things. These are hearsay or truth, I can't say. But it's coming from a source. I can say it's R.A. Parker here. Where he got it from, I never asked him. I'm in his class and I have enough problems with the language. I did hear from other people, and it was just gossip, that he had cut a hole in the wall, a little aperture, before the seals were broken. Because to get into the tomb, you got to obviously destroy the wall, right? You take it out bit by bit, and they're sealed as if you had they're big seals. And so before the unsealing, shall to speak, before the natural destruction by an archaeologist of the wall, the entrance door, really, the entrance wall, he had looked in and saw what was there. Whether that is kosher, shall we say, a useful term to use in this case, or not, I leave up to anyone else. But it doesn't mean that he had it wide open and was taking things out, you know, bit by bit. How could he do it? It'd be impossible to take the largest stuff out. And that's why the thing of Sir Alan Gardner in 1934 is significant, because it's like this happy face little canister you have for cleaning your hands. It's tiny, can be put into a vest. They'd be wearing vests then, and be put into a pocket. And if you're really sneaky, into a cuff of the pant, of the trousers, of course. These I know from police, how you really do it. That's why they frisk you, right? They frisk you in certain places. So it got out that way, because if Carter took it and someone saw him take it, then he's in trouble. So he did it surreptitiously. I think the 34 case is reasonably proven by Breyer in that. The rest, I haven't, to be honest, read the entire book. It's just recently been published. I read the Guardian thing when it came out. I think Sunday I read it, and then I read the blurb that I got this morning by you, from you people.
It brings up an interesting discussion about the idea of someone else's culture and history, how Howard Carter kind of would have thought it's okay to take out of interest, or whatever his motives would have been. The fact that he felt that he had a bit of ownership over some another like culture's history.
That's a good question. I often wonder if it's really ownership. I mean, there is the problem of if you were to take something from, say, I'll give you a good example, in the destructive war of the Khmer Rouge, would you take, say, and they destroyed a lot of the Buddhist stuff. They wiped out the Buddhist stuff. They wiped out the pre-Buddhist stuff at Angkor Wat. Would you take something to preserve it? So you see, you have that, which you're a foreigner coming in and doing it. So there is that. The locals can be as nasty as the others. In fact, in this case, they clearly were worse historically. I don't know if he felt ownership. He was protecting it, because these are tiny little things. I think it's an acquisitive portion of the personality that has an acquisitive instinct, shall we say. I'd like to take it. Like if you see something on the ground, somebody's wallet, you take it. Do you return it? Question. Or do you just go through it and take the money and throw the wallet away? Or do you take the whole thing? Or if it's even bigger than that. So you have that acquisitive instinct. And I think that archaeologists have to have an acquisitive instinct, because they're trying to acquire material culture, something three-dimensional, something you can feel, touch, smell, its color and everything. And so it's a bit different than a scholar who sits back and, say, me, who's working on, tell you, I'm working on chariot wheels at the moment. I can see the photographs. I deal with the origin of certain aspects of the fellows. This is all chariot stuff, the spokes and the like, and the ultimate chariot. But I can do it without touching, you see, and without excavating. So I don't have that strong instinct. And it, in fact, I would say, if I look at myself in the mirror, I would say not that. I don't really have a pack rat instinct. But it is often the case that you get scholars that do. They may be great, they may be minor and insignificant, but they still want to accumulate. And it is a theft. It is theft. It's just theft. It's cultural theft, but it's theft. Theft is the real word that you use for it. And so I think Breyer is right to bring it up, whether it fits the present concept of trying to have a resolution of the problem, I don't know. Because this has been going on, as you know, worldwide with stolen artifacts. It's worse after the Second World War than that. I mean, you know very well from your own country.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear. I mean, it's not simply desecration, which I, in a sense, the desecration is worse because you wipe out the object and knowing to see it again. Anyway, I leave it as that.
I want to talk about also the impact it's had on Egypt as a country, also with like the museum in Cairo, which is now like, it's a lot of the artifacts are now located in Giza.
That's right. That's the new museum there.
Yeah.
They've got two museums, the one up at Giza on the plateau, and the original one is just in Midan Tahrir. That's the one founded around 1880s or so. It's actually the second one. So there's a second and a third. I think, you know, from the Egyptian point of view, this will not affect them that much. I think, there's always questions over the Nefertiti head. Could have me for another, which I know more about, have me for another discussion. In this case, the Germans are involved and Ludwig Borchardt is involved because the Nefertiti head is the big one that you go to Berlin and you see it. It's painted. It's the beautiful head. Did that go or not? Was it hidden and then allowed to go out? They are still very angry over that, but the data are unclear, as are most of the data with respect to Carter, except this is a good example where you know it isn't, and it's clear that there are others. I'd like to know, if you will, the vectors that goes from A to B to C. Not that I want to punish anyone. I'm not an immortal judge wishing to trial, conviction, prison situation, but to find out how these things actually occurred. Because they're very commonplace in that era. They're very commonplace today. I grew up when they were very commonplace in Mesoamerican archaeology. A lot of the ceramic ware from Peru, for example, was very prominent. And I also remember as a child studying Italian sculpture and the like, certain things that disappeared from Italy after the war. And the other cases. So I think it's something that everyone has to be on guard against. And fortunately, today the museums have taken a very strict, I mean, it's not strict, they've taken an absolute legal point of view. And that is excellent. But there are private collectors.
Yeah. And like, pretty much the final point is about like the fascination with ancient Egyptian like culture, history. And like, while, Harold Carter had taken stuff like the amulet.
You say the amulet can be proven. I think it can be proven. I mean, everything, of course, is a probabilistic thing. And then when you're in a little courtroom, it becomes highly probabilistic. But I think in this case, there is no doubt. You've got at least a record. You've got a written record there, not just people talking. Like I started talking about the Princess Eugenie. It's just talk and the fact that he may have broken through the wall, the entrance wall, at the beginning before going in, which shouldn't be done, though it isn't archaeologically illegal. But I think it is part and parcel of a rediscovery of past experiences that I don't like to use the word sorted, that are not appropriate, weren't appropriate at the time for Carter in 1921, let's say 21 or 31. In 1880, irrelevant. Egypt was not independent by Turks, so the Turks were occupying the country as well, so you could say they're taking it from the Turks, you know. It isn't their culture at all. And say 1780, you know, people say this is what happens. But today, in 2022, it's a century after. I think, by the way, that's why Breyer has it out. It's a century after the discovery and fits very well into the public's conception of the tomb of Tutankhamun at this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Like you obviously know something about it without having to study it, and it's part of the cultural elements.
And like the fact that historically we now know more about a culture that we didn't
know much about. We didn't really know. And it's us, like you as well as me. It's, you know, it's like the thing.
Yeah, and that was Tony Spellinger discussing with me about Tutankhamun's tomb and its grave robbing and the context around that.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.